The story of the promise. And today I want to look at how do you know? How do you know all of this Jesus stuff is true? And really, my goal for you is that you will get in touch with the historical reality of God's story. This isn't just some bedtime story for children, and it's not just something that we drag out on Sundays or for VBS or Sunday school. This stuff really happened in history. And I hope that you, as we go through this study, especially this segment of it, the story of the promise, I hope you will make that connection and see it the way they saw it and put it in our historic context, because it still applies. Some of the same things are going on today. Now, as I thought about, you know, what about this story captivates me? Well, I don't know about you, but I love a good mystery, especially spy thrillers, the kind written by guys like Tom Clancy or Robert Ludlum. I just listened to a couple of his on the way out and back from the reservation, in fact, last month. And I mean, nothing makes Nevada go by faster than a good spy mystery. You know what I'm saying? It is great. I don't know if I could survive all of those trips. Well, you know, that's what God's story is. That's what we've been trying to say since January. It's like a mystery. It's a thriller in many, many ways. The problem is, it's not laid out linearly for us. If it were, it would make it much easier to understand, because he would just say it straightforwardly in a straight line, and it would make it a lot shorter. Instead, though, it's laid out like a very complex mystery that has many, many twists and turns, and it covers a span of 66 volumes. This is a long story. And just like any good story, especially mystery, God's story has the ideal condition. Any of you guys watch Monk? Come on, admit it. Oh, you guys got to get with it. Monk is one of my favorite detectives. But you know, in season one, the love of his life, Trudy, was murdered. They had a love like no other love. He still has pictures of her after seven seasons hanging in his room. And he still obsesses about her. Robert Ludlum mysteries that I read, I mean, he just goes on and on ad nauseum about how wonderful this woman was and what a perfect love they had. But, well, you know, God's story is very similar to that. It starts out in Genesis 1 and 2, God creating and saying, man, this is good, this is good, this is good. And then he gets to the part where he makes man and woman. He says, wow, this is very good. It's perfect. It's ideal. They're in the perfect situation, enjoying life the way it was intended to be lived. But just like in a good mystery, there enters a compelling problem that must be solved. See, unknown assailants murder Trudy. And for the next seven seasons, Monk is trying to figure that out. He's only solving other murders and other mysteries incidental to the real one he's trying to solve, and that is, who killed Trudy? I have to find out. Well, in God's story, the same thing happens. An unknown assailant. Well, we're not exactly sure of who he was, but we have a good idea of who he was. He's called the serpent there. He comes in and he says, oh, really? Is this really perfect? Has God said? Did God really say, you know, he's just holding back on you with that tree of the knowledge of good and evil because he's really not good and generous. He really, there's something missing. And if you'd only reach out and grab that, it would all come together for you. And so he creates a problem. And now instead of enjoying openness and freedom and transparency, all of those things, they experience guilt and shame and fear and death and destruction. Enter the story. and enter life on earth. And it doesn't take long to see that, man, it is pervasive, it's widespread, and it is horrible. Well, as in any good mystery, there are some plausible solutions that twist and turn and make the story even more complex than it already is. And most of these so-called solutions don't work in the first place, but they also sometimes cause the reader to doubt that there really is a solution even possible. But like all good stories, the resolution, the mystery is finally solved. There's a happy ending, or at least closure to the mystery, but it's rarely what we expected it to be. There seems like there's always another little twist to the story. Well, in God's story, Genesis 3:15 is the heart of the story. And he says there, he's speaking to this unknown assailant who he identifies as the serpent. And he says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers, and he will crush your head and you will strike or crush his heel." See, in God's story, we know who the hero is, the rescuer is. At least we know a little bit about him. He's a descendant of the woman. But we don't know exactly who he is. We're not sure of his exact identity. But over the course of the story, buried in the many, many twists and turns of the story, we find numerous hints as to our identity. Now, I want you to try to put yourself in God's story. Try to imagine that you are living in ancient times, and you are waiting for this problem to be resolved. You're waiting for the end of the story. You're waiting for this promised one to come and restore all things. Now, you only have the first 39 books, or first 39 volumes of the story, and it kind of ends rather abruptly without a real solid conclusion. It's kind of like the Robert Ludlum book I've been listening to. I listened to two volumes of it, like 11 hours on the way home, and I'm, oh man, I got to get to the end, got to get to the end. I'm listening to it in between drives up and down here, and all of a sudden it just ends. It's like, what? That's a pretty lame ending. I mean, it's just kind of, you didn't resolve the thing. Well, then I found out there's another volume, 5 more hours. Well, that's kind of what it was like to be living in the Old Testament. All of a sudden, Malachi finishes, and it's over. You don't know there's more coming, but it's like, whoa, what happened here? What if you were living in those times? Try to imagine yourself as we look through some of these things that you're there. Would you recognize him? Would you recognize the promised one? How would you know it was really him? I mean, God's not going to put a sign on him, especially if a lot of other people claim to be him. There were other possible solutions that were plausible. Well, we think it was Jesus, but how do you know for sure? Well, buried in the many twists and turns of God's story are numerous clues. And we're going to just look at a few, and I do mean a few. We're going to look at 8 out of several hundred that are there that pertain to the identity of the promised one. Clue 1 is that he will be male. It says that right there in verse 15. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. So the promised one will be male. That eliminates at least 50% of the human population. So we're narrowing it down, right? Okay, we're looking for a guy here. Clue 2, he will be Semitic. This clue is seen in Noah's blessing of his 3 sons, in which Shem is given a position of superiority over his brothers. In Genesis chapter 9, verses 26 and 27, Noah says, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth, and may Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave." He's going to be a Semite. He'll be Semitic. Clue 3, he's going to be a Hebrew. He will be Jewish, if you're following in your notes. Clues regarding his Hebraic heritage are found in several of the covenants in the book of Genesis. The first one was the covenant, the promise made by God with Abraham, who, by the way, was one of Shem's descendants. In Genesis 12, 1 through 3, the Lord said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." He reiterates it in Genesis 17, verses 2 through 7. "I will confirm my covenant between me and you and will greatly increase your numbers." Now, notice there's a great deal of emphasis placed on his descendants, his seed, in the terms of Genesis 3:15. "Abram fell down, and God said to him, 'As for me, this is my covenant with you. You will be the father of many nations. No longer will you be called Abram. Your name will be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you." Again, in Genesis 22:18, "And through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you obeyed me." Now, how are all the people on earth, all the nations on earth, blessed through Abraham's offspring? Well, the promise, the promised one, the promise of redemption and restoration of God's creation includes all humanity, not just a select few, but it will be through Abraham and through his offspring that this one will come. Now, when Abraham and Sarah were nearing their hundreds, you have to note, after listening to God for years, say, okay, all your offspring, many nations, all these kids, man, you won't be able to count them. They still have no children, zero, and they're pushing 100. And they had all but given up on the promise being fulfilled. Man, it looks like, boom, mystery is over. We're not going to solve it. So in another act of human autonomy, instead of trusting God to faithfully keep his promise, Sarah, very reminiscent of Eve's actions back in the garden, convinces Abraham to sleep with her servant Hagar. And she gives birth to a son, Ishmael. Plausible solution, right? Oh, okay, this is how it's going to work. I don't think so. Ishmael was not the promised one, as the Muslims still believe. He was the one from whom the Muslim nations came. Now, that hasn't worked out too well for Israel, has it? Not only is it not the solution, it's created a big mess. They're still fighting one another and trying to wipe each other out, aren't they? Here's a lesson I take from that. Don't play God. Let God be God. Let him do his job. He knows what the story is. Remember, he wrote it. He knows where it's going, and he knows how he's going to resolve things. Ishmael would not be the line from which the promised one would come. In Genesis 17:9, God said, "No, Sarah, your wife, will bear your son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him." Now, if you're trying to figure out the mystery, if you're trying to figure out the identity of the promised one, how are you going to know? Well, the clue limits the possibilities to half of Abraham's descendants. Not going to be Ishmael, it's going to be through Isaac. The covenant between God and Abraham is later confirmed with Isaac in Genesis 26, 3 and 4. God speaking to Isaac says, "Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands. I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth will be blessed." So he reconfirms that with Isaac. The covenant between God and Abraham is again confirmed with Jacob, Isaac's son. One of Isaac's sons. Remember, he had two. Genesis 35, 10 through 12. God said to him, "Your name is Jacob, but you will no longer be called Jacob. Your name will be Israel." So he named him Israel. And God said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. Does that have a familiar ring to you? Yeah, have you read that somewhere in the story so far? Yeah, several times, huh? Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a community of nations will come from you, and kings will come from your body. The land I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I also give to you, and I will give this land to your descendants after you. Clue three, the promised one will be a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, further narrowing the possibilities of his identity. Clue four, he will come from the tribe of Judah. Jacob is later renamed Israel, as we read there, by God, and he has 12 sons. They become the nation known to us as Israel. So now there's 12 possibilities, right, that we can go, that are plausible solutions, any one of these 12. Just before his death, Jacob pronounces a prophetic blessing on each of his sons. The prophecy about Judah provides a clue to the identity of the one who would be greater than Judah himself even. In Genesis 49, 8 through 12, Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah or the ruler's staff between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. Kind of an interesting thing to say about a normal kid, isn't it? That the nations will obey him, and the one to whom it belongs, rulership belongs, will come. Now, God is progressively making it easier and easier to identify the promised one by narrowing the possibilities of who can and cannot be him. He must be a descendant of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob and Judah. Clue five narrows it down even more. He will be from the family of Jesse. 1 Samuel 8 through 10, remember the nation Israel demanded a king, and so Saul was chosen. Now, he looked like everything you would want in a king. When I read the description of him in 1 Samuel 9, I kind of imagine this Brad Pitt-looking guy, you know, tall, muscular, good-looking, got the eyes, got the look. I mean, he looks kingly, okay? That's kind of the reaction to him. But remember the previous clue. God said the scepter will not depart from Judah or the ruler's staff from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. In 1 Samuel 15, though, God rejects Saul, and the scepter literally passes from between Saul's feet to the family of Jesse in 1 Samuel 16, further narrowing the possibilities from which the promised one can come. Then in Isaiah 11, verses 1 and 2, we read, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom, of understanding, a spirit of counsel and of power, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Isaiah, in the Isaiah context of the story takes another twist. It's looking like Israel and the promise are goners. Remember, they're in exile during this time in their history, and it's not looking like there's ever going to be a king ruling over Israel again. But out of the ashes, a remnant survives, and from that stump, as Isaiah calls it, a king will come who will make all things right again, and he is the promised one. So clue six further narrows the possibilities. He will be a descendant of King David. 1 Samuel 16, we read that Jesse had 8 sons, more plausible solutions, 8 of them. Each one passed before Samuel and looked promising. In fact, they didn't even bother to call David because he was the youngest, kind of the runt of the litter, so to speak. And he wasn't even, in their mind, he wouldn't even be a possibility. And as each one of those guys walked by, Samuel's even impressed by some of them. But in each case, God rejects them until the 8th. And the very youngest comes before him. And God tells Samuel that David is the one that he has chosen to be king. And so Samuel anoints him. Then in 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 16, God makes a covenant with David that directly relates to the promised one. He says, "The Lord declares to you," now the prophet Nathan is speaking to David here, "that the Lord himself will establish a house or a family line for you. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers," in other words, when you die, "I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name." Now initially, this was Solomon, but as we'll see, the promise looked, I believe, way beyond Solomon. He says, "I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." It's not going to phase out. "I will be his father, and he will be my son." And as we, well, never mind. I'm jumping ahead in the story. I don't want to ruin the ending for you. "When he does wrong, I'll punish him with a rod of men, with floggings inflicted by men. But my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house, your descendants, and your kingdom, your rule over the earth, will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." Now, let me just remind you, in Genesis 3:15, not only has a promise attached to it, promises us a redeemer, it also says that there will be hostility. There will be a deadly conflict between the descendants of the woman and the descendants of the serpent, who I believe is Satan or Lucifer. I believe that's why we have so many attempts throughout the centuries to exterminate the Jewish people. Lucifer is willing to do anything to stop the promised one from coming and crushing his head. And he has opposed him and those people tirelessly throughout the centuries. Now, there's a little known example of how close Satan came to actually stopping the promise. In 2 Kings 11, verses 1 through 3, when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she proceeded to destroy the whole royal family. She's killing off all of David's kids. But Jehosheba, the daughter of King Jehoram, and sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the royal princes who were about to be murdered. She put him and his nurse in a bedroom to hide him from Athaliah so he was not killed. He remained hidden with his nurse at the temple of the Lord for 6 years while Athaliah ruled. Joash eventually comes out of hiding after she's dead, becomes king, and becomes the grandfather of Uzziah. There's another clue. And he is listed in a very important genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, if you want to write that down and check it out later. So the promised one must be a descendant of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Judah and Jesse and David. And if Athaliah had succeeded in destroying David's family, it would have cut off the line of the promised one, and Lucifer would have won right there. Man, talk about a close call. Talk about a thriller. It got down to one person. Now, all those clues relate to the promised one's lineage, his family tree. The next clue relates to his birthplace. Clue 7, he will be born in Bethlehem. We find that clue in Micah 5, 2. "As for you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, seemingly insignificant among the clans of Judah, from you a king will emerge who will rule over Israel on my behalf, whose origins are in the distant past." That's the NET Bible. And according to the NET translators, the phrase "origins are the distant past" refer to periods in the history of the world. They can go back a long, long way, or in the history of the nation Israel. Other translations kind of give it the nuance that I think it is intended there. They translate it from eternal days, or from everlasting, or from the days of eternity. And this is the promised one. So in the Hebrew scriptures, they keep narrowing it down. The deeper you get into it and search out these clues, it keeps narrowing down the possibilities of who the promised one could be. He must be a descendant of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Judah and Jesse and David, and he has to be born in Bethlehem. Well, that's getting pretty tight, isn't it? Dialed in. A last clue gives us a hint as to when he will be born. You could have been expecting him if you were paying attention. Clue 8. He will be born about 450 years after the reconstruction of Jerusalem. Daniel 9, verses 24 through 26 provides this clue. Daniel says, 77s or 70 multiples of 7, 490 years, in other words, are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know and understand this, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. Now let's take a look at some of the time markers that Daniel gives us. He says, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, that is the promised one. He's called, starting in about the Psalms, he begins to be called the anointed one or the Messiah in a lot of our translations. And they were looking for the Messiah in the New Testament. They had kind of gone, they weren't saying, well, we're looking for the seed. No, they were looking for the deliverer, the salvation, the bringer of salvation, the Messiah. And so they're calling him Messiah or anointed one through most of the Old Testament. And so we're still talking about the same person. And he says, when this anointed one, this Messiah comes, there will be, from the issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, there will be 7 sevens and then 62 sevens. And then Jerusalem will be rebuilt. So the clock starts when a king issues a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. In 444 BC, Artaxerxes issued such a decree to Nehemiah. And it took him 49 years, or 7 sevens, to finish it. So we can expect that the promised one will be born after Nehemiah's decree, after Nehemiah finishes rebuilding Jerusalem and the temple, which is about 395 BC, but before Titus, the ruler of the people who will come, destroys it, the city and the sanctuary, in 70 AD. We know that's when that happened. So it's after Jerusalem is rebuilt, but before it's torn down again. So if we're studying the clues and we're trying to figure out, when's this going to happen? When do we find restoration and redemption? You're looking at all these people that he's going to be related to, somebody born in Bethlehem, somewhere between the time that the Jerusalem is rebuilt and it's torn down again. Narrows it down, but it's still a pretty big spread, isn't it? It really is more specific than that. 483 years after Nehemiah rebuilt Jerusalem, that's what he's talking about there, that additional 62 sevens, the promised one will be cut off and have nothing, it says. In other words, he will be executed or killed 483 years after Nehemiah finishes rebuilding the temple. Now, if nothing else, if you're living, you know, you're a Jew and you're living around Israel, Palestine that time, and, you know, you come to the Passover and there's this big hullabaloo and they drag some guy out who claims to be the Son of God, the Anointed One, and they crucify him. It's like, uh-oh. I mean, you can at least look back and say, I wonder. Now, the Jews followed a lunar calendar, so it would help us to convert those items to those dates to a solar calendar. So by our solar calendar, without going into all the formulas and stuff, we could expect the promised one to be executed in about 33 AD. So if you're living in the first century, you're looking for the promised one to come and solve the problems created by Adam and restore God's creation, how will you know? Well, he will be a Jewish male who can trace his roots back to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Jesse, and David, and is born in Bethlehem 450 to 483 years after Nehemiah rebuilds Jerusalem. You know that date when that happened. Now think about that. You know, that just might explain why Magi came from the east, where Daniel's prophecy is believed to have been widely circulated, to Bethlehem looking for a baby Jewish boy in Matthew 2. You know, it might explain why King Herod insanely ordered the execution of all male children born in and around Bethlehem about the time the Magi showed up. Read that in Luke 2 also, or Matthew 2. It could be why an unmarried Jewish virgin and her righteous fiancé accept the bizarre explanation of her pregnancy. You read about that in Luke 1, starting verse 26 in Matthew 1. It could also be why an old priest in Jerusalem, who had been, as Luke says, looking for the consolation of Israel, he had been looking for the promised one all of his adult life. When he held a certain baby, this could be why he said, "Sovereign Lord, now let your servant die in peace as you have promised. I have seen your salvation, which you have prepared for all people. He is a light to reveal God to the nations, and he is the glory of your people, Israel." Luke 2. Here's the thing. These people, and many like them, had been looking for the promised one. And they had been studying God's story for clues. And when all the pieces fit, they concluded that Jesus of Nazareth was the promised one. Now, I ask you at the beginning, try to put yourself in their place, in the place of those living during Jesus' time. And remember, this isn't going to be like some Charlton Heston movie where it all makes sense because you're watching it unfold. You're going to be just like everybody else, just like us today, involved in the routine pattern of life when all this stuff happens. Would you recognize him? How would you know it was really the promised one that you've been waiting for centuries? Well, here's the thing. We don't live back then, do we? But you know what? We are still looking for him. The problem of the fall was only partially resolved in the first century by Jesus. We have received redemption. Jesus did suffer the death God warned Adam would happen if he ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Like the Apostle Paul says in Romans 5:17, "For the sin of this one man, Adam, caused death to rule over many. But even greater is God's wonderful grace and his gift of righteousness, for all who receive it will live in triumph over sin and death through this one man, Jesus Christ." He is the one. Jesus is the promised one, and through his life, death, and resurrection, we can be reconciled to God and freed from the bondage of sin and death. For sure, that's done. But we're still waiting for the final solution. We're still waiting for the promised one to come and take back dominion over the earth originally exercised by Adam but lost to the serpent. And so much like the people of Jesus' time, we are looking for his appearing. But how will we know it's about to happen? That it's really him. How will we know it's really him and not some counterfeit? We have to read the clues. And it's that is such a serious and important thing to do. The scriptures warn us that the serpent, called the dragon in later portions of Scripture, will deceive many into believing that his seed, his offspring, his descendant is the one, and they will follow him to destruction. Jesus warned about this in Matthew 24:24. He says, false messiahs and false prophets will rise up and perform great signs and wonders as to deceive, if possible, even God's chosen ones. You see, what he will do is going to be very convincing and very compelling. Revelation 13:11-14 contains a similar warning. Then I saw another beast come up out of the earth. He had two horns like those of a lamb, but he spoke with the voice of a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast, and he required all the earth and its people to worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. He did astounding miracles, even making fire come down from earth from the sky while everybody was watching. And with all the miracles he was allowed to perform on behalf of the first beast, he deceived all the people who belonged to this world. Now here's my point, and the first thing I want you to take away from this message. Number one, Jesus is the promised land, and he is going to return to earth. He is going to decisively crush the serpent once and for all. He will destroy him, and he will establish his rule over the earth. And we are told repeatedly to be alert and watchful, lest we be deceived into following the false prophet and ultimately the serpent himself. How will you know? Are you looking for the clues? Are you filtering the news and the events of our times through God's story? It's still not done. It's still on. It's not old ancient history. It's contemporary, and it's happening and unfolding under our very noses. Are you seeing it, or are you missing it totally? If you're not studying the clues and filtering the news and current events through God's story, you are subject to being tricked by the serpent's deceitful schemes. Now, this is one of the most important things that I can tell you about the Christian faith. It comes from chapter 1, verses 1-4. Actually, this is really what got those first four chapters got me thinking in this direction as I prepared for this Sunday. He says this. This is Luke writing. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. Not just happened. Fulfilled. Just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I have myself carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good to me also to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Now, there's several observations that I want to make from these verses. Luke and other witnesses like him recognized the events of their day as the fulfillment of something. And the first four chapters of his gospel make it clear that he is referring to the fulfillment of everything said about the promised one throughout the entire Hebrew Scriptures, starting at Genesis 3:15. Now, if you miss everything else in this message, don't miss this. This is the biggie. This is probably the most important thing I could tell you about Christianity and about our faith. Unlike other religions, the Christian faith is subject to scrutiny and historical verification. Now, that may just sound like some intellectual mumbo-jumbo. Our faith certainly involves experience. It certainly involves faith, the exercise of faith, but not experience that is above scrutiny or blind faith. Don't believe it just because your parents said. Don't believe it just because you heard it in VBS. Check it out. If it can't stand up under the scrutiny and the verification of historical fact and documentation, then toss it. Our faith is not a blind leap. It is a submission of our lives to the God who, as Francis Schaeffer said, who is there, and he has spoken clearly about himself and the world. The Christian faith is a faith based on historically verifiable evidence about events surrounding the coming of the Promised One that happened in real time and in a real place. Our faith is anchored in reality and history. Now, far from producing a Spock-like cold religion, this historically verifiable faith produces what Luke says, certainty of the things we have been taught. We don't have to guess about it. We don't have to wonder about it. There is so much evidence, so many clues. We could go on here for days just talking about them and then seeing how they came together in the first century in Jesus. Now, I suspect that we may be entering a time in which our faith will be severely tested. If your faith is based on how it makes you feel, it will not stand the test. If your faith is based on stories that did not necessarily happen, it will not stand the test. If your faith is not based in the reality of history and real places, it will not stand. Now, over the next 11 weeks, we're going to look at the story of the promise and our belief that Jesus is the promised one. A lot of the questions that we dealt with last week in our question and answer time really question the relevance of the Old Testament to us today. You know, we should be involved more in the New Testament. Keyword is new. It's for us. It's about Christians. Well, we're going to see how Jesus' story connected to God's story throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, but also in the New Testament. The New Testament lays it out for us and sort of starts wrapping up the mystery for us. We're going to see how the eyewitnesses who lived during Jesus' time interpreted these events surrounding him. This is going to be a good study, so don't miss it. Now, I'm going to close. I'm going to give you some homework. I want you to go back sometime this week and start reading Luke 3, starting at verse 21, the baptism of Jesus. And notice how it transitions, or it really doesn't transition very well. It goes abruptly from one thing to another seemingly out-of-place thing to another thing. And think about that in relation to the things that I've been talking about today, we've been talking about since January, about God's story. Then go back and start at Luke 1:1 and read the first four chapters and try to see through the lens of a mystery, and the clues are starting to come together and be explained and make sense. And see if you don't see the connections between Jesus' story of the promise, and God's story. Okay? That's your homework assignment. Let's pray. May Jesus find us alert and watching eagerly for his return when he does return. May we diligently search God's story for clues, and may we be alert to the signs of the times in which we live, lest we be deceived or lulled into complacency. Amen.